Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today, we're going to be discussing the incessant flooding of African cities, causes and consequences. I'm joined by a very special guest, Professor Taibat Lawanson, Professor of Urban Management and Governance at the University of Lagos, and Leverhulme Professor of Planning and Heritage at the University of Liverpool. Professor Lawanson's research focuses on the interface of social complexities, urban realities, and the pursuit of social justice in Africa. Taibat, I'm very happy to see you once again, and I look forward to our conversation.
It's always a pleasure. Thanks very much for inviting me.
Brilliant. So let's start off. Last year, 2024, was seen as Africa's worst flood year, flood in years. Many countries across East, West, and Central Africa experienced unprecedented level of floods that caused a lot of damages. What are the factors behind these levels of flood?
So the factors behind flooding are multifaceted. One is urbanization and the increased concretization of space. The second is the climate crisis and the changing nature of our planet. And, with sea level rise, ocean surges and things like that, as well as extreme weather events, hotter, dry seasons and much stronger or much wetter rainy seasons. And so a combination of these factors has tended to make the flooding situation critical in many African areas, cities particularly, because now we have a higher urban footprint. And so with a higher urban footprint comes increase in unplanned spaces, increase in areas that are not well planned. And when you have the urban poor tending to gravitate towards environmentally hazardous areas, when these kinds of issues occur, they have a higher intensity, higher implications, and unfortunately, they leave a lot of destruction in their wake.
Very interesting. You've mentioned two things, and what I gather is there are, like in the literature, people talk about human and, natural induced factors. You did mention climate change, and also mentioned the human side would be, the urban, the town planning. You talked about concretization of spaces and all of that. So I wanted to ask, what factor, if you're going to, is more... what factor is primary to the flooding? Would we say it is human-induced? Would you say climate change only exacerbates it? Or would you say they have equal weighting in this flooding?
So it depends on the location, really. Take, for example, in Nigeria, northern Nigeria, or rather north-central Nigeria, over the last few years has had, these really serious floods that have taken over towns and things like that. Many of these places are not well planned. and the planning does not usually align with the topography of the area, and that's why we have these disastrous consequences. But the intensity of rainfall has also, you know, resulted in a situation where even for places that are planned, the infrastructure is not able to hold or contain the avalanche of the floods. In Lagos, in parts of Lagos, you have these flash floods that happen, and 15, 20 minutes after the rain, everything has cleared. And there are some other places that if you have a 6-7 hour rain, the whole city just grinds to a halt. And then there are human and material consequences. You find sad stories of children being washed off in the flooding because they can't tell the difference between the drainage and the streets. And you have things like that. You have people's houses getting inundated with the flood and destroying their assets and all of that. And sometimes it is simply because the rain comes with such a high intensity that the infrastructure that is on ground cannot handle it. So I won't say it is one factor. It is actually a combination of both factors, you know, urbanization planning, as well as climate change and the interface of both factors.
We've seen, you mentioned, funny enough, you mentioned Nigeria. So we've seen in recent times, was it last month, where Niger State.
Niger State.
Yeah, where there was a whole city was, and there was lots of lives that were lost to the flooding. And also you mentioned Lagos. We've seen somewhere around, but again, I wanted to clarify, you talked about the migration patterns between rural and urban migration and how the urban poor. But if you look at places in Lagos where you might call those places where the flash floods, in Lekki, and those places seems to be like a bit of highbrow. Would you say the kind of stuff we've had, flooding in the south and north of Nigeria, what distinguishes? Is there any distinction? Because these are like coastal. In Lagos, we're talking about coastal cities close to the Barbican, and all of that. And then in the north, these are like, inland distance. So what are the differences in these flood patterns and manifestations of flood in these different topographies? Mm-hmm.
So the planning of Lekki, unfortunately, the urbanization of that space preceded the planning. And so many people had already moved into the area. And with the private estates that were generated, a lot of the drainage patterns are not interlinked. And so we have, you know, a challenge in that axis. And also when you look at how proximate they are to the Atlantic Ocean on one side, to the Lekki Lagoon on the other, it is just, unfortunately, a disaster waiting to happen. And that's why when the rain comes down, places like that grind to a halt because moved in, and then the city government is now trying to make a bit of sense out of places that are already well established. So the fact that an area is a highbrow area doesn't make them immune from flooding and these kinds of environmental challenges. It may result in a situation where the government pays more attention to them, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they are immune. And now when we think about the topography of Lagos as a coastal city, and just oppose it with that of the north central area axis of Nigeria that has seen some really serious flooding in the last few years, we see that those places are also, Lokoja, for example, is where the River Niger and the River Benue meet. And a lot of the development and planning along those areas have not respected the topography. It's commonly said that water always finds its level, and that is what, you know, we're seeing happen. we also see that communities in Lagos, for example, Igbo Efon, Alpha Beach, and places like that, they are also practically going extinct simply because the water keeps coming. And that's why it's important that when we're thinking about planning, when we're thinking about development, we have to think in line and in with respect to nature. There's a term, biophilic architecture, that seeks to design space in alignment with the natural order of things, taking lessons from how nature has arranged, you know, the system, and then leveraging on that. And cities like Rotterdam, like Amsterdam, have actually adopted that kind of design. And so even though Amsterdam and Rotterdam as cities are way below sea level, we don't hear such catastrophic news out of them with regards to rain and flooding and things like that. So our design, our urban design, urban planning approaches need to change. And we must also recognize that the society or the spaces that we find ourselves were spaces that were originally designed by nature. And so we have to align with nature's plan while we do our development. Another issue that I want to raise also is with regards to these large cities and how quick development is happening, and particularly vertical development that may not necessarily be paying attention to greens, that may not necessarily be paying attention to the implications of, you know, these kinds of things. It's not only flooding that is becoming an issue. In large cities, we're also having the urban heat island where places are becoming really hot and we can't even go out during the daytime, and the intensity is made greater because of the road pavings and the tall buildings that are reflecting sun and heat back to the human beings or human forms, I will say, that are in those spaces.
Yeah, I remember in the but in the 70s when Nigeria had the oil windfall, they participated in the this kind of white elephant project, and then they had the dams, the integration of those dams in those places. So I guess what I'm getting to is a lot of people have made the case, and which is true, that Africa cities, African countries are vulnerable to this climate change, but ironically, Africa has contributed about just around 4% to global warming, the things you've mentioned, this global warming. And then why should Africa bear the brunt? Why should it sacrifice? We're talking about greens and all of that in terms of its development, developing or industrializing, because some of this industrialization pressures could also lead to this. How does this occurrences fitting into that? Do you believe that Africa should? Do you think that argument is right? Because we've seen also places where plant cities, where, like, I like the word you use, where you say they don't respect nature. And I think that refers to Nigeria, where they don't respect places that are planned, where there should be a park. There should place a place where there should be a park, and then it's just all house. There's places where should be routes for grazing of cows, and these places are turning to houses. So how do you see these kind of arguments?
Okay. So I think it's it depends on what side of the table you're sitting. Yeah. So if you're sitting on the western part of the seat of the table, you'll be saying, oh, we are in a crisis and everybody has to go green, everybody has to respect the environment, everybody has to look towards net zero and all of that. But if you're sitting on the developing country side, you know, thinking about generational exploitation of our resources and how those resources were used to build these so-called developed nations, then you have a rethink about it. That how come this argument is coming after you guys are relatively sorted? And why do we have to also look to you for green infrastructure? Why do we have to look to you for the technology? Why do you do we have to look to you for the investments? Why do we have to look to you for the policy direction? And that's where I will say that African leaders need to kind of get their act together when we're thinking about issues of decolonization, issues of African futures. We also need to be very pragmatic about it, right? The president of Nigeria, for example, in the early part of his tenure was saying things about, well, climate change, you have to take a, we'll have to take a pause, except they are ready to fund our development, our industrialization and things like that. And so there's a justification for that kind of position when you think about global geopolitics. But then again, there's only one sun. I mean, there's only one sky over all of us. And what's happening on this part of the world affects, you know, people on the other side of the world. How do we reconcile these issues? How do we get to a central agreement where Africa is able to industrialize, urbanize at a pace that is commensurate to the pace that the West did it? There are two ways about it. It's time for innovation, right? And it's time for us as Africans and African leaders to prioritize what's really important. And I know that when we think about local communities in Africa, looking at micro-scale development and things like that, we have quite a number of solutions. How do we catalyze it in a way that is profitable to us? And I think that's a conversation that African leaders need to have. It's a tough one. But it's a conversation that needs to be had if the future of Africa is going to be secure.
If we talk about, so we could talk about, what is the readiness level? Speaking of African leaders, we could also look at it in terms of like, bring it down to the relevant departments or institutions that are for this kind of issues, like, you know, occurrences. So what is the readiness level of those kind of, like, it might be Minister of Urban, Minister of Time Planning and all of that. So we, with the recurrent issues, we can take a guess and say at the preventative level, not much has been done. But even in the defense, how much ready are they? Is the issue of capability? Or what are the issues that affect them? Or what has, how has it varied across maybe different countries or different cities? In
At an institutional level, I think most African countries are committed to addressing these issues. We are all bound by the targets and the indicators of the Sustainable Development Goals, and we have one Sustainable Development Goal that is committed to climate change. We have another one that is committed to sustainable cities and communities. And so that is like an anchor point for most cities. And so they are able to derive institutional alignment or institutional benchmarks based on this global agreement. So most African cities, most African countries have that commitment. That's one. The second one is, how does it dovetail into actual action on the ground? The challenge that we have in Nigeria, for example, is that there's a Ministry of Environment and there's a climate change unit within that ministry. And that climate change unit is very busy, is very on their toes, looking at how to do legislation and programs, national programs and, you know, practices around moving us in the direction of climate awareness, climate readiness, and things like that. Unfortunately, climate change is not something that a department can do. It's something that needs to be mainstreamed across the entire spectrum of human endeavor. The challenge we then have is that what is Ministry of Tourism and Social Development, Ministry of Health, Ministry of Agriculture, what are they doing? How are they setting their practices to ensure that they are prioritizing these climate sensitive realities, that they are working towards climate resilience? So that's a challenge we have. We have a kind of siloed approach to addressing these climate issues. In Lagos, the Ministry of Environment, I think, starting from yesterday, there's a total ban on the use of single-use plastics. But we still have a lot of construction that is not, that's happening outside of that ministry that is not climate-friendly. You know, they are using bamboo beams for panels and things like that, which is, you know, spoiling the environment. And you see practices in other ministries and development. Okay, so for example, Ministry of Waterfront, they are giving out licenses for dredging, which kind of exacerbates the flooding problem. So how do we reconcile this kind of siloed thinking? How do we get everybody to mainstream climate smartness into their operations? That is the main problem. And I'll say by way of capability and capacity, usually at the national level and at the subnational city level, there's a lot of capacity. It's when we get to the municipal level, the local government, that there are certain gaps, at least in the case of Nigeria, where many of the development initiatives do not align or are not prioritizing intentionally these kinds of issues. We also see that there is a lacuna between the knowledge that is being generated in the universities and the knowledge institutions and the practices of government. So if we're going to catalyze, if we're going to leverage, we need to work to find a way in which universities are working with government institutions. South Africa has got that right to a certain extent, but you know, those kinds of relationships need to be deepened, especially in other parts of the continent.
Very interesting. You and that still also comes back to leadership. When you talk about this siloed approach and how you don't see so much of inter government or inter ministry kind of like connection. But if you look at you earlier on, you mentioned the city and how the city is designed. You did mention Lagos, you mentioned Lekki and how people moved in there before it was properly planned. Unlike Abuja, because I think like Abuja is a planned city, very, very planned. But then again, so in those instances where people had gone to live before planning, how can you reverse that from an architectural perspective? Is it possible to reverse? Is it possible to how do you address those kinds of, be in alignment with the planning and with nature?
Okay, so there are certain things that we need to take into consideration. Some of the concepts like urban regeneration, urban renewal, urban transformation. Cities are a conglomerate of systems, and cities also operate in cycles. So you have young cities, older cities, and things like that. So a city may be planned and then go through obsolescence because the infrastructure becomes old and things like that. And so we need to renew. Cities also go through phases where you have a high concentration of people, and when, for example, the economic advantage is lost, people start to leave. And so, you know, the city suffers and things like that. The situation we have in a place like Lagos is that there's a high influx. People are coming in search of economic opportunities. Some of them see Lagos as a city of refuge. You know, people are generally coming in, and the resources and infrastructure is insufficient. And that's where the challenge comes in, where people, you know, now move into spaces that are not yet planned in order to survive. Abuja, for example, is a planned city on paper, right? And aspects of the city particularly the aspects that are aligned with the place as the center of Nigeria and as the seat of Nigeria's federal government is planned. But Abuja has a systemic defect in that it was planned for civil servants, right? And did not acknowledge the fact that civil servants come with families. Civil servants are of different hierarchies. And the civil servants are also human beings who need to shop, whose children need to go to school, who need to recreate and things like that. So a city that is developed and doesn't take into consideration the whole society approach will have challenges. And that's why you have people who are living in far-flung places and moving into Abuja. Abuja is also a center of contestation because the people who used to stay there, the indigenous people of Abuja, are yet to be fully compensated for the taking over of their land for this public national agenda. So you have those kinds of things. Some of them are refusing to stay, are refusing to leave, I beg your pardon. Some of them are leaving and causing challenges in the city. Some people are living on the city margins, on the urban margins, literally and figuratively, literally taking over spaces that are unused, vacant lots, parks, public spaces, and figuratively by way of income, by way of the informal economy and all of that. So you have this nice planned city and you have a mess around its borders. That's what happens. That's what has happened in Abuja. And that's simply because in thinking about or in developing the city, we did not take into consideration the people on the lower rungs of the ladder who also have a right to the city and who service those who are already in the city. So city development dynamics, when we're thinking about urban regeneration, we have to prioritize what needs to happen. How do we maintain the legacy of the city? How do we ensure that the challenges that the city is confronting today are adequately addressed without developing new challenges? How do we ensure that each approach results in co-benefits for the people, for the economy, and for the environment? And I would say that it is a very difficult task. It's a very difficult task. And so those who are mandated or who are tasked with the leadership of the city have to be very innovative. They have to be very ambulant, mentally ambulant, and they must be able to recognize that there is value, there is agency in every cadre of society, and work towards creating, you know, a city that works for everybody.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because a lot of time when we look at these issues, like we look at these issues in isolation without looking at it in a very holistic way. And I'm glad you mentioned, and I think that's one of the reasons I've told you before, we should do a project like where that intersection between the urban planning and conflict. And I'm glad you've mentioned that, because even here in matured places, you see where people that are in that feel that this is their community, and then they're being whisked away under the guise of we need to what you've just said, you know, regenerate, renew the space and make it, and then it becomes gentrified. And then before you know it, you know, people of a higher class, and then they can access that, they can afford those places, and it looks like they're being pushed into the peripheries and the margins, and this brings conflict and stuff like that. So I'm glad you mentioned that social dimension of things. So, but again, you're also talking about how all of this involves like people, infrastructure, and movement, which leads to migration, and how that But let's stay on that, on the human social dimension of things, and look at a place like Nigeria or even in Africa, because people have had to move from where they are situated to other countries, and then they put pressure on those places and they create further pressures and all of that. How does all of this play out? What is the interplay between all of this? If you could elaborate more on how all of this, you know, play out.
Okay, so I'll speak a bit about some work that we've been doing in Nigeria on issues around displacement. So in Nigeria, displacement is of two types. There are people who are displaced through conflict. Some of the conflict is, you know, terrorism and all of that. And some of them is simply climate induced, like what we are getting in Nigeria's central region, where herdsmen who are facing increasing drought are coming lower so that they can feed their cattle and their, you know, cows and all that. And they are infringing on people's farms, and that's causing, you know, these contentions. So we have a high number of internally displaced people. We also have a lot of development-induced displacement, like you spoke about, those who are being removed from their homes because of the economic value of the places they currently call home. But what is causing is that there's a high level of homelessness, there's a high level of dejection, and what most people do is that they tend to remove themselves physically from places of pain, places of home, hopelessness as it is. And that's what causes, that's what has increased the migration wave we've had into cities over the last 10 years, at least in Nigeria. And if we're thinking about Lagos, Lagos is now hosting the highest number of IDPs outside of northern Nigeria, because people see Lagos as a city as large enough to absorb them, to give them anonymity, and to help them start life all over again, provide economic opportunities, and in some places provide liberty, particularly for women who have been in societies that were very patriarchal. So the city holds that advantage. But this wave of people into the city is also changing the dynamics within the city. It's causing new slums to be developed. It's causing new squatter settlements to be developed. And now we're being confronted with new forms of mental health challenges and new forms of urban violence because of the kinds of contestations between hitherto traumatized people and fearful host communities. So these kinds of contentions, these kinds of changes we're seeing. But it's not all negative, because we're also seeing new kinds of skills in the city. We have a high level of people with agricultural skills who are moving into the city. And it's an opportunity perhaps for us to upskill them so that they can help in addressing our food insecurity issues, our urban food insecurity issues. It's also causing issues around hybrid identities, where people of different tribes are coming into the city and, you know, enhancing that heterogeneous nature of cities, cities as places for all. So while there are quite a lot of challenges, there are also opportunities. And migration is a, migration can be a fantastic opportunity to change lives, to do things differently, and also for the city to reinvent itself, for the city to evolve, right? And what I see, particularly from watching the kinds of interactions between different classes of migrants, we're seeing new learnings. We're seeing, you know, situations where people are adapting, integrating quite well. In some instances, you know, we're seeing these kinds of tensions and clashes, but you can't do away with it. There's economic migration. People will continue to move, and places like Lagos will continue to have attraction. And we are in an urban age globally, and so people will perpetually be attracted to cities. What I think is that we need to start looking at migration as an opportunity and start working with it. If you see, countries like Canada have taken advantage of migration to increase their population, to increase the diversity in their country, and increase the opportunities that perhaps are available. Places like America are also, you know, a country of migrants, some forced, some, you know, willing, but it is a country of migrants, and the diversity and the things that are attractive in those kinds of countries are really perhaps the flavor of the multiculturalism and the advantages, the new knowledges, the acculturation that comes with having people of diverse knowledges, diverse ethnicities, diverse background in a place and being able to collectively call it home. And I think that's the opportunity, you know, that cities hold. And it's left for city governments to really take advantage of that opportunity, to leverage that opportunity to build a more inclusive future for the people.
Okay, makes sense. So I like how you've also highlighted the positive. And I think I've written a bit on that, on how migration is looked upon and how we need to rethink how we need to look at migration in a positive sense. But before I come to the last question, you mentioned earlier on that when it comes to this impact and how one thing can happen here and has impact globally somewhere else. So speaking of that, we've seen other kind of like external agencies or external organizations or humanitarian organizations like the International Organization on Migration, UNESCO, and all these people. What role do they play in mitigating? Is it just humanitarian responses? What role do they play in dealing with these issues that come up with these floodings and all this kind of stuff?
You know, migration can be legal. It can also be irregular. And when you have a lot of these catastrophic events, people move in a hurry. If they move across country lines, then they become refugees, right? And sometimes, I know in the Chad axis and things like that, especially where we have these porous borders, people move and not, you know, it really doesn't make any difference. And but I know that when these kinds of things happen, the humanitarian agencies usually rise to support those who are vulnerable and those who are negatively impacted. An agency like IOM, for example, I think their work is mostly to support legal migration through, you know, all those blood tests and things they do to track patterns of migration, both legal and irregular. And I know in the past couple of years, they have been supporting the return of migrants, people who get stuck on the way. People who are victims of human trafficking, because those are some of also the dark underbelly of this migration story. And agencies like that have been supportive of helping to rescue victims of those kinds of unfortunate circumstances. But I insist that if we handle migration well, we won't need to, if we handle development well, we won't have so many people wanting to go through irregular means of migration. And it all comes back to this issue around prosperity and the responsibility of a government. The responsibility of a government is to ensure that people have a conducive environment to achieve their highest potential. And what that means is that the rich have a right to get the opportunities that allow them to increase wealth and to get the benefits that they want. And not so rich, people like you and I. People like you and I, and you know, people who are lower on the rungs of the ladder, also have a right to have the opportunities to be able to better their lot in life. And that's why in countries where fundamentals are given, every child must go to school. Every sick person must have access to good health care, you know, and you must have, you know, the fundamentals that allow you to lead a basic life. That, and the government is committed to those kinds of things. You find out that there's a higher attraction for migrants to go to those kinds of places where people are guaranteed relative stability for their station in life. And that's what leadership is about. It's not the rich against the poor. It is actually the government ensuring that everybody at each stage in their journey has what is required, the basic requirements to live a lawful, decent life. I think that conversation around leadership and governance really needs to be had. The idea of, you see the Minister of the Federal Capital Territory talking down to people. You see commissioners, you know, talking down at people. It should never be in a system where you respect people, where people, you know, should be guaranteed the right to development, so to speak. Those kinds of things, you know, are really an aberration. I think the Nigerian government, the African development context, that conversation needs to be had about what value do we place on our people? Because that value is what really determines the kinds of policies, the kinds of programs, the kinds of investments, the kinds of commitments, whether it's with regards to flood control, whether it's with regards to displacement, whether it's with regards to, you know, fundamentals like the right to an education or the right to decent housing.
I agree with you 100%. And my recent experience has made me to start questioning or looking at putting these kind of conversations in context, because I was looking to renew my Nigerian passport, and I'd asked someone back in Nigeria, and they say state of origin, and I get a letter. I'm like, what does that mean? And I'm like, what am I going to stay? I'm going to be state of origin. I'm like, if we are still talking about that, in a sense, I start looking at post-colonial African states haven't developed a nation. So because they've not developed a nation, because the nation will be one where it is of duty and of responsibility, where the citizens have responsibility and they have rights. So it's kind of like mutual. You have responsibility. So if you call upon to fight for the country, and the nation has responsibility, rights that they need to provide. So these things are happening because post-colonial African countries, many in Africa, are not nations. So we still continue in that stuff. And that's what needs to shift. And you did mention education early on in terms of like the disconnect between what is being studied in the places of higher education and what is a policy. So these are all of those disconnects that are still, we need to sit down and deal with those fundamentals. And once you are a nation of, then you know there is a functioning government, your responsibility is towards the people. So I agree with you 100%. So let me come to the last question. Speaking of that, I think this will be part of your answer. What should be done in the short, medium, and long term to address these issues of flooding and in all of these issues?
So in the short term, I think it's a localized issue. You know, places where flooding is happening, we need to find immediate solutions, from things as simple as clearing a drain to moving people to higher ground and things like that, and helping those whose lives and properties have been destroyed. That's the short-term humanitarian. In the medium term, we need to start rethinking how we're planning and redesigning our cities. Like we talked about, the biophilic approach, thinking about planning with respect for nature. I think that has to happen. And this time around, we are planning with respect for nature and for human beings. That is something that needs to happen in the medium term. Urban regeneration, urban renewal, you know, development approaches really need to change. And we need to be more sensitive towards those issues. And in the long term, I think especially when we're looking at Africa, we need to kind of rethink and reorder our priorities. Our priorities from the context of geopolitics, and also our priorities from the context of our responsibility, the social contract that our leaders have with our people. How do we ensure that decision making how do we ensure that decision making as it relates to Africa is in the interest of African people without alienating us from the rest of the world? That's one.
Yeah.
And how do we ensure that the leadership decisions that are being made are made with the people in mind? How do we ensure that people, like I said earlier, the rights to the city, the basic rights to development becomes central to the aspirations and the leadership decisions of our of, you know, our cities and our countries? And I think that's really it. We have to do the practical now, and then we have to do the thinking for the long term.
Brilliant. Prof, thank you very, very much for this very rich and insightful conversation. I really, really appreciate it. Hopefully, the people that are right, people that are supposed to do this, we hear this and then do what we need to do. But once again, thank you very much. I really, really appreciate your time.
It's been a pleasure. And
have a lovely day.
Okay, then. Thank you.
You too. Bye.
Bye. Okay.
Thank you for tuning in today. And as usual, join me to thank our guest, and actually one of our fellows, Professor Taibat Lawanson, for her very incisive and rich insight into the increasing flood in African cities. For now, stay blessed, and I'll see you next week.